So we had the chance yesterday to begin to look at the first parak of Esther with open eyes. To look for specifics, to actually look with open eyes at the psukim carefully and notice the pieces that seem to be out of place, things which are present, which you would expect not to be present, things which are not present, and where do they go, the ways in which the psukim describe things. We also had a chance to think more largely about the first parak of the Megillah in light of Nevuah Shehutzrach L'Doros Nechteva, Nevuah Shehutzrach L'Doros Lo Nechteva. So yesterday I had a chance to generate some questions. Let's review some of those questions and let's see where the Malbim takes us in terms of putting this together. In the very first pasuk, a pasuk that's so familiar to us, and yet what's with the Hu Achashverosh? We say that was Shlomo. Who's Shlomo? Oh, Vayelech Ishmi Beis Levi. Who is from Beis Levi? What does that mean? And it's the one place in the Megillah where he's not referred to either as Hamelech Achashverosh or just Hamelech. He's just plain Achashverosh. And repeated, Hu Achashverosh. Instead of hearing him being called the Melech, question number three, what we do hear him called is Hamolech. Mehodu va'ad kosh. He's molech. That's a word we don't find. So we have the Hu Achashverosh. There's no melech. And it is molech. And then moving to the next pasuk, Kesheves ha'fan, now we hear him for the first time referred to the Melech Achashverosh. We need to hear that he was sitting on his Kisei Malchus. Later on, so you would suggest he made some sort of foreshadowing. Later in the Megillah, as we know, when Esther approaches him, the yeshiva al Kisei HaMalchus is going to be critical. But the Kisei HaMalchus here, the Kesheves, what's that all about? What do we need to hear about Shushan HaBira? Then the third pasuk. The invitation list is bizarre. A bizarre invitation list. All the local people, all the lowly archers and soldiers are invited before the Sari HaMedina. So the Seder HaKruim is very strange. And the Lefanov. What's with the Lefanov? The Sari HaMedina's Lefanov. The last item on the list are the governors of the provinces who are before the king. It means some of them couldn't make it because they lived a couple thousand miles away. Well, okay, if they couldn't make it, they couldn't make it. And he didn't invite the people who couldn't make it? What's the significance of that? I mean, they're alive now as opposed to people who lived before? What's it supposed to mean? And then, the next couple of psukim, the sheer degree of detail, particularly in Pasuk Vav. The Ray begins in Pasuk Hey. And we hear about the party. Pasuk Dal, we hear about the party. We wonder why. And then in Pasuk Hey, we hear about the second party. And we wonder why again. What's with the second party? And then already we start hearing details about the Chatzar, Kinas, Bisa, Hamelah. The Seder. And then you get to Vav. And the details just explode. Sounds glorious. Sounds like it's very pretty. Must have been a visual smorgasbord. The purple and the green and the white and the blue. Wasn't gorgeous? But why do we need to hear about alabaster floors? Shite. Achashverosh was very wealthy. He lived in a big mansion. He lived in a palace. Shkoyach. But again, what's he doing in the Tanakh? Certainly it's true. But as we were talking about yesterday, not every historical detail needs to appear in Tanakh. Not every major historical narrative over the era of Tanakh has to appear in Tanakh. There are entire nations who are active in the ancient Near East who don't appear in the Tanakh. Only historical details, historical events that appear in Tanakh are those which happen to also are not only of historical interest, but Hutzrach L'Doros, have some eternal message for all generations. What is this supposed to mean? And then you hear about Vashti HaMalka, she's making her party. And then everything unfolds. But again, just in the first few psukim alone, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 major questions just in the first 6 psukim. The first thing we learn is that Torah is very rich. If we actually open our eyes and look, there's a tremendous amount to analyze. And so yesterday, the Tzitzis party, we would do well to re-examine with maturing eyes those parts of Yahadus that we had the schus to meet when we were little. And the schus to meet Yahadus when you're little is an incredible bracha, but a bracha that we said yesterday that does come with a challenge or a potential risk, and that is you could, with inertia, stay at your six-year-old level forever. Unless you do what we're doing now, which is to work against inertia and to actually throw yourself in and begin to figure it out. So the Malba makes a remarkable suggestion. It says, let's begin with the Seder HaKeruv. What's with that order? What's with that order? The soldiers are the Parthamim, for the entry-level people, they're being invited first, and then the governors of the provinces. And what's with the Lefanov? So he suggests, you know, maybe Lefanov means before him, not spatially in front of him, face to face, but Lefanov meaning the time sense, the temporal sense, who had come before him. Sari HaMedinos, who had already been in place before Ahasuerus had become the emperor. Ahasuerus is a fresh emperor. It's only year 3. And there are people who have been in power for a long time. Sari HaMedinos, someone had been in charge of Carthage, someone had been in charge of Ethiopia, someone had been in charge of Greece, and maybe Gaul, for a long, long time. And someone had been in charge of the area of the Himalayas, Hodu and Kush, the Hindu Kush Mountains. Take a look at a map, you'll find it there. Machlokas, Gemara's, Rav and Shmuel, either Hodu and Kush are next to each other or very far from each other. Machlokas and Metzias, the answer is no. The two different places referred to as Kush. Kush refers to Ethiopia, which is very far from India, from Hodu. But there's also, if you check a map of the Himalayan area, you find the, I believe it's a range of mountains called the Hindu Kush Mountains. And the two different Kushes, Machlokas is to which one does the Megillah refer. But regardless, the vast empire, Ahasuerus is not the founder of the Persian Empire. This has been around before. The machinery has been in place. The bureaucracy has been in place. And there are people who have been governors for 10, 20, 30 years of their province. They got invited second. First he invites people lower on the totem pole, and then, but Sarav Avadav, his people, his Sarim, his Avadim, and the soldiers, and then finally, the end of the list, will also invite the guy who's been in power somewhere, who's been running a province for the last 30 years. That's fascinating. And then you work around to Pasuk Dalet. The question of why there's that first party. So the Pasuk tells us, why did he make party number one? The 180-day party. Why? He wanted, what does it say in the Pasuk Dalet?
To show off
how wealthy he was. And Osher Kavod Malchuso and Yikar Tiferes Gedulaso. The wealth, the glory of his kingdom, the glory, the splendor of his greatness. What's the recurring pronoun? His. He's trying to show off his money, his power. And in case you didn't, and then you have to ask yourself also, the end of the pasuk, the truth is also repetitive. We'll add another question, we'll make it 12. The end of the pasuk says, Yamim Rabim Shmonim Ma'asyo. It's pretty redundant. I can figure out on my own that 180 days is a long time. Depends for what. not long for a lifetime. It's very long for a party. 180-day party? Let that sink in a little bit. 180 days. For two whole seasons, they were partying. Ze aroch. It's like from Sukkot to Pesach. That's how some people misconstrue what senior year is. That's very deep. But I can figure out on my own, I can count. 180 days, that's a long time. Why does the Pesukim have to stress Yom and Rabin? Think. It is very long. Elamai, says the Malbim, when you begin to realize, as you actually look at the Pesukim, and as things come into focus, all these other details will fall into place too, is Achashverosh had a plan. He had started as Achashverosh. As the Gemara tells us, he was not born into royalty. He was a commoner who apparently amassed a fortune and bought his way into power and bought armies and conquered and succeeded and worked his way up. Worked his way into power, and as the Gemara tells us, solidified his power by marrying up tremendously. Marrying in Vashti, a descendant of Nebuchadnezzar, the greatest emperor of the previous empire, the Babylonian Empire, which had been Nebuchadnezzar's grandson had been overtaken by the growing Persian Empire several generations ago. He's pretty powerful. But he has dreams of something bigger. So the Malbim says you could have a limited monarchy or an unfettered absolute monarchy. You could have, if you study ancient history, you'll know that these forms of government have the earlier antecedents. It says an emperor could rule in conjunction with a senate, or in conjunction with a group of sarim, or he could rule totally. And fundamentally, the question is, Malbim says there are five differences. There's a conceptual difference and four practical nafkaminas. The conceptual difference is, what's the role of the Melech? Is he the steward of the people, or is he the owner of everything? Is he a constitutional monarch, or is he a feudal lord? And there are four practical nafkaminas. Number one is money. Who owns the royal treasuries? Are they national coffers of which the king is an executive, a trustee? Or is it his personal fortune? Nafkamina number two is, how does he make decisions? Does he need to work in concert with the Sarim and Yoatzim? Or is he just an absolutely independent, unilateral decision maker? Number three is, do the laws apply to him? Or can he just do whatever he wants? And number four, if you're part of a larger scheme of government, so not only are you constrained in general by pre-existing law and precedent, but you're also going to maintain the capital city as it was before you. Whereas if you're an absolute monarch, you're totally in charge, you can do whatever you want. And so the Malbim suggests that Achashverosh's plan was, I've gotten this far, I'm going to go for the gold. I've worked my way up from being a commoner, and with money, and perhaps military success, marrying up, I vaulted myself up into the position of being a constitutional monarch. We're going to go all the way. We're going to go for total power. And so, he moves to Shushan HaBira, moves his Kiseh HaMalchus to Shushan HaBira, because again, he's Achashverosh. From this point on, from the start of the next pasuk, he's always the Melech. But the Megillah begins by giving us a picture that he started as Achashverosh. Yimei Achashverosh, he had started as plain Mr. Achashverosh before he became his royal HRH, His Royal Highness, or H.I.H., His Imperial Highness, King Ahasuerus, he had begun as Mr. Ahasuerus. Hamolech, he was ruling, and grew into the Melech, but he ruled over a vast empire. 127 Medinos. Now, Bayal Mehaim, Pasuk Beis tells us, now he's moved in. He's moved into power, but now he wants to, she shifts his Kisei Malchus to Shushan. Archaeologists tell us there was more than one capital city of the Persian Empire. There was Persepolis, there was Susa, which we call Shushan, and the Malchus suggests that Ahasuerus is the one who moved to Shushan as a mark of his independence. He's not merely king because he's part of a line of kings that came before him, he's part of tradition. He's in charge because he's in charge, and that's it. And then, not only does he move, but then he has a series of parties which are carefully calculated to make this point. There's a reason why the expenditures are so lavish and why the Tanakh tells us about it. Because Ahasuerus pulled out all the stops. 180 days, in case you didn't get the point, yum and robin. Very excessive. A totally excessive party. Who are you to spend the money that way? We have a national budget. There's a budget for celebrations. And Ahasuerus says, I couldn't care less. The money is mine. A demonstration of his total power. And that's why the invitation list is carefully crafted. Who comes first? Sarava Avadav. Who comes first? The people that I appointed. Oh, the Sari Hamidinos, the people who had held power, they're going to come last. I'm going to teach them that in the new regime, no one is higher or lower. Protects you from beforehand, Yichus from beforehand, no, that helps. I am the sole source of power. That sort of totalitarianism is what Ahasuerus is seeking to communicate. And it takes it to the next level by throwing a party afterwards for commoners, and to bring them into, as the Megillah stresses, Chatzar Ginas Bisan Hanah. Isn't that courtyard? Their face is the garden, the royal garden, as a total violation of royal protocol. You can't allow commoners into there. That's for the aristocracy only. No longer, says Ahasuerus, there ain't no aristocracy. It's me and everyone else. I am the total sole source of power. And Ahasuerus is trying to make the point in many different dimensions, in how things are crafted, and how he's spending money, where he repositions his capital city. And you'll notice the Pasuk Vav, which was that incredibly elaborate description of the over-the-top spending and decor, is specifically the second party. He invites all the common people in and overwhelms them with his money. Because if you happen to live in my new capital city, that's a chashivas. The fact that you're the governor of Western India, Ahasuerus says, I couldn't care less. You're the governor of Macedonia, Ahasuerus says, I couldn't care less. You're no more, no less than any other subject. I am the sole source of power. Oh, but you're my neighbor? You live in Shushan? That'll give you some chashivas. We'll make a party just for the commoners of Shushan, pulling out all the stops. So that's Ahasuerus' plan. Ahasuerus is seeking to rebrand himself as an absolute monarch. And the marketing is very thoughtful. There are a lot of pieces in place to get that brand out. And he's trying to get buy-in from everyone. Let's stop for some questions, then we'll see the next step as Parag Alf unfolds. Yeah, the doubt. Great. Excellent question. This is Ahasuerus' plan. Why is Ahasuerus' political intrigue relevant? Great to us? Let's hold on.
Based off of the nuance in the pasuk, making a idea about the fact that it says Shoshana Bira or Mandalay or whatever that it's emphasizing this point. It's not Akash Mirror's emphasizing that point. Dylan emphasizes that point.
Right. So two things are in order. Number one, definitely one of the overall goals of Tanakh in general, but Megillah Esther in particular, is to look at events and sort of pull certain events out into sharp relief, to focus in on certain events, to gray out everything else, and focus on key events, and to not only to look at the events, but to elicit what were the motivations for the event. That's something you see throughout. Sometimes the Megillah is even explicit. And Haman says, "Belibo, Ramiach Potsa Melech," etc., etc. We get the Megillah allows us to listen in on sometimes quiet conversations and sometimes internal thinking, what's motivating different people. And I would suggest to you, let's see how the Perek Aleph unfolds, that Perek Aleph is relevant in terms of setting us up in certain ways to rest in Megillah, but I would suggest that once you take the Malbim's approach to the Psukim, you step back, and so we're not done yet, I think you step back and see that Perek Aleph also stands on its own as an independent unit with independent lessons for us. So let's see where it takes us. Yeah.
Two better.
Sure.
First of all, when you said the Megillah talks about conversations that happen when you go,
right,
whatever, how
do you
know about what Haman said?
Great question. The Gemara discusses it. Gemara, I think, says either it was Ruach HaKodesh or you could intuit, you could figure out what he was thinking.
Also, you can tell me if this seems correct, but maybe when Ahasuerus put the order of the people invited, put the Sarim that were before it in last, it was more than just what you said. It's also that he's trying to ditch any supporting power, and these are the people who have the supporting power. So he puts them last, he denigrates.
Well, exactly. Exactly. Absolutely. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. A little louder. I wasn't there, I'm not sure. But one can, I think, sketch it out that if you have armies, if you have money, you can buy soldiers and you can buy power and you can buy influence, for better or for worse. And Lamasa, if you have military power, as we've seen time and time again throughout the 20th century, when someone gains control of military power, they can often push their way into political power. For better or for worse. Sometimes, as we've seen repeatedly over the course of just the 20th century, with very, very tragic results. I've seen over the course of the 21st century also. Someone, a terrorist, is in a position of leadership and manages to, puts himself in a position of leadership over a military group, and now he's a force to, sometimes becomes a force to be reckoned with. Not sure. Not sure. I can't hear you. Yeah, he invited them. Oh, you have to keep your enemies close. But he made it clear that they weren't getting the type of cover that they were used to. They would be there, but they weren't getting... And that was actually a much more powerful statement than not having them there at all, was to have them there, but not to show them the sort of deference that they would have gotten in the past. It was a more powerful statement, and it was also important that they, from his perspective, that they be there. Yeah, Noam. Noam and Zakai, then let's continue.
Can you say if the reason he also invited soldiers was message to them?
I mean that his soldiers were, if the army was the source of his power, that was his power base. Very possible. Very possible. Yeah.
Is that these things have hazardly and without thinking, and maybe it's what was forth. He was just doing whatever he wanted. He just wanted more power, 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 power. He didn't care about men.
So I wanted to hold on to that thought. The Gemara does have a machlokes because how we should understand the mentality of Achashverosh. So let's hold on to that point. Yeah.
So why do we need all the detail right at just saying like Bar Osiris Moshe would not be so it's funny enough to say that he's
perhaps perhaps
to say exactly what costs they had and
perhaps. I guess it gives you a sense, though, of the... Again, we're not in the in the Chur market, or the... We are in the Tehillos market. We're not in the Bahat market, although you can buy alabaster, I think, nowadays also. We are in the Tehillos market, and, you know, if you figure that a few strings can cost you $100, imagine what a... curtains of solid Tehillos cost. The draperies alone were like $500,000. That was just like opening sneeze. So it gives you a sense. I said your contract goes out, that's one thing. But to say they spent, you know, talk about, you know, how much you spend on an inauguration ball, you know, track that historically over the course of the history of the United States of America. This blows everything away. Blows it out of the water. But in response to both your questions, let's see where things go. Vashti makes a party also, which the Malbim suggests you read the Pesukim slowly and carefully. Vashti makes a party, which Achashverosh understands is a counter statement. Achashverosh understands that Vashti is trying to lay her own claim to power and point out that your power is because of me. And Achashverosh fits her into, says you can make a party in the Beis HaMalchus Asher LaMelech Achashverosh. The location is important because Achashverosh will only have her make it on his grounds. And that explains also the flow of what's going on B'Yom HaShvi'i K'tov Lev HaMelech B'Yayin, and the 187th day of partying. Achashverosh is now perhaps more than a bit inebriated. His judgment is not at its sharpest, but he has a plan. His plan is, remember, why did he ask them to bring Vashti? To bring Vashti HaMela, HaMalka Lefnei HaMelech Becheser Malchus. Let's take a look at Pasuk Yud Aleph and Pasuk Yud Beis. He tells the seven Sarisim, Lahavias Vashti HaMalka Lefnei HaMelech Becheser Malchus. Bring Vashti the queen before the king with the royal crown. Laharos HaAmim VaHasarim Es Yofya, to show everyone how pretty she is. Kitovas Mari, because after all, she is very pretty. Which is repetitive. And you wonder, what was the whole purpose to begin with? And what's Vashti's response? Vatimo'ein ha-malko Vashti lavo b'dvar ha-melech asher b'yad ha-sarisin. Queen Vashti refuses the king's order, which had been delivered by the Sarisim. In these few psukim, there are so many questions. Number one, is she Vashti HaMalka or is she HaMalka Vashti? There's a switch from one pasuk to the next. In pasuk Tesh, she was also Vashti HaMalka. In pasuk, when she made the party, she was Vashti HaMalka. When he calls for her, she's Vashti HaMalka. When she says no, she's HaMalka Vashti. And what's with the Keser Malchus? She should come before the king with the Keser Malchus. And what's with the showing everyone how pretty she is? Now again, he may just have been inebriated and saying absurd right. things. Since when do you drag out your queen like, what is this, a beauty pageant? You're going to show off to everyone how pretty your queen is? What's a bizarre thing. And to top it all off, she refuses to come bidvar hamelech. The next three words are entirely redundant. Pasi good days. But Tamein Hamalka Vashlavo bidvar hamelech. Queen Vashti refuses to comply with the king's word. Could have stopped right there. The Megillah has Asher Biyad HaSarisim that was delivered by the pages, by the chamberlains, by the Sarisim. We just said before in Pasuk Yud that he sent the Sarisim to get Vashti Amalka. So we understand that this is the word that would be HaSarisim. Why is this being repeated? So again, Vashti Amalka or Amalka Vashti, what's with the Keser Malchus? Why is he doing this? Why the redundancy of Yafya Kitovas Marihi? And why the redundancy of Asher Biyad HaSarisim? All five questions, the Malbim points out, fit in perfectly as the next step in this, the next act in the drama of Achashverosh, or maybe the next scene in Act 1. He wants her to show up. Why does he want her to show up? Why does he want her to show up to show everyone how pretty she is? She is indeed pretty. He told us Mari. She is gorgeous. And why does he never want everyone to see how pretty she is? And why does he send? Why do we have to hear the Sarisim that he sent to get her? Right. What's he trying to say when he says you should know that my queen Vashti, she's incredibly pretty? And no one, the first thing they're telling us is that he's an incredibly crass harlot. Okay, but that's what we notice when we watch Achashverosh in action. But what's Achashverosh trying to communicate? He's not doing something exactly. He's in charge, and Vashti is his queen. Now he doesn't need her yichus anymore. He doesn't need her royal blood. Again, it's the same rebranding. I'm in charge because I'm in charge. Because I'm the big man on campus, because I'm in charge. And I'm married to her because she's very pretty. Nothing more, nothing less. I don't need any political leverage any longer from Vashti's yichus. And that's why he doesn't come to get her. He doesn't send Sarim. This should have been, you would have expected one of the top people in the empire to come get the queen. Proper officers of protocol. Instead, he sends Sarisim. He sends the hired help to go get the queen as though she's garbage. And as he insisted in Pasuk Tess, you're merely Vashti Hamalka. You're Vashti. Who is the queen? Your party will be, as he insists in the Pasuk Tess, on my turf, not on your turf. It'll be Beis Hamalka Asher L'Melech HaChashverosh. When he sends her, he sends Sarisim, mere Sarisim, lowly Sarisim to get her, and to address her as Vashti Hamalka. You're not independently a source of power. You're just my queen. And the Malbim suggests, what's with the Keser Malchus? It's, she should come lifnei HaMelech beKeser Malchus. Show up in front of the king and then put on the royal crown. In other words, more loaded symbolism. You'll put on the crown when you're in my presence. Because you're the queen, Achashverosh is trying to say non-verbally, because you're married to me. I'm not the king because I'm married to you. Let's be clear about where the source of power is here. You're the queen, whatever was, was. But now you're merely the queen because you're the king's husband, and not vice versa. You're Vashti, who happens to be a Malka. You're not inherently queen. You'll show up in my presence, and in my presence, you'll put on the crown, and everyone will see how gorgeous you are. I want everyone to see how pretty she is. She was indeed pretty. Kitovas Marihi. That's the redundancy. She was indeed pretty. That's true fact. But he's trying to show everyone that that's all that she is. Rachamal Nitzlan. Once again, as I said before, it bespeaks incredible shallowness. We were talking the other day, Mesil Sharon, about how the Torah is profoundly opposed to the objectification of women. So we are profoundly opposed to what Achashverosh is representing. But not only is there that element, but this is also all about political power and intrigue. And the psychodynamics of the Persian court in the chess game that they're playing, so he has this massive move, she pushes back, I'm going to make my own party. He says, it's fun, but you remember, you're merely Vashti Amalka, and your party will be on my turf, on my terms. And then the coup de grace is supposed to be the final touch. The Shalom Bayis issues were quite severe. And the final touch is supposed to be when he shows off on the last day of all these parties, he's going to demonstrate to everyone exactly where power lies and how Vashti is merely his wife. And yes, he's a very shallow person. He merely married her because she's pretty, as opposed to being a shallow person who married her for her yichus. He's a shallow person who married her for her looks, because power is his. And that's why when she says no, she understands exactly what's going on. Pasuk Yud Beis, that Tima'ein, who says no? Hamalka Vashti. She's like, excuse me, I'm the queen. I am a descendant of Nebuchadnezzar. Let's get things clear, Prince Consort Ahasuerus. You're king because of me, and not vice versa. And that's why the pasuk repeats that the Dvar HaMelech was sent Asher Biyad HaSorim. If it would have been respectable, the way a king would speak to a queen properly, by all means, doesn't necessarily have to come himself, that's fine, but to send a respectable message in a way that shows his respect for his queen, that you would have been glad to consider. But you send me a message like I'm garbage? You send me a message with the Sarim? The Dvar HaMelech Asher Biyad HaSarim? That's why she says no. She says, excuse me, I'm HaMalka Vashti. And the response is dual. But Yiksof HaMelech Ma'od V'chamaso Bo'ar Bo. Again, why the repetition? Because, as Ariel pointed out before, clearly, on a personal level, their marriage was very, very far from what a healthy marriage should look like. And they were trading nonverbal barbs back and forth. And he was personally He was personally insulted. But not only was he personally insulted, she's thwarting his political plan. Not only is it a punch in the gut, but at the height, he's at the climax of his plan. He moved the capital, New Kisei HaMalchus. He's spending totally over the top, tens if not hundreds of, probably billions of the equivalent of billions of dollars. More than a half a year of parties, of food and wine at royal levels for probably thousands of people for 180 days. And then for hundreds of thousands of people for a full week. Again, we saw that before, the decor alone is probably tens of millions of dollars, if not more. He spent billions of dollars on this. Mamash! Everything was in place. And then the final capstone was going to be, he's going to show off that Vashti is merely Nebuch, his wife, because he chose her. Nothing more, nothing less, not a source of power. And at the very height, everything's about to climax, she comes with a little needle and deflates his balloon. And he is furious. And then what happens afterwards is a very important case study to watch. He becomes furious. And in his fury, he calls in his Yoatzim to discuss Kedas Malasos Bamalka Vashti. What are we going to do about this? And the Malbim suggests that by the time he calls them in, he's calmed down. Malbim suggests that he didn't call in the usual judges, he called in the Ro'e Pnei HaMelech, unusual term, in Pasuk Yud Dalid, the people who see the face of the king. What does that mean? Perhaps it means people who are with him all the time, who could once again read his nonverbal communication. And they'll get a sense of what he really wants. Because you'll notice that when he lays before them their task, their mission, in Pasuk Tezvav, Kedos Malasos, what should we do with whom? Malkavashti. All of a sudden, the king is referring to her as Queen Vashti. What she gained this thumbs up from the king for? Because he's calmed down. And he did, when he wasn't being entirely unreasonable, appreciate time with Queen Vashti. He liked having her around. And so now he's a little bit of a bind, because he's been very public that she needs to be punished. But now he's starting to reconsider. The wine wore off. The initial flare of temper wore off. But he has to save face. She needs to be judged because of what she did in public. She needs to be judged because initially his response was fast, furious, and enormously loud. But he wants to keep her. So he packs the court with the Roe Pnei HaMelech, the people who can read his expressions, who will understand the nuances that he'll be hinting to them. Of course you're going to judge her, but you'll judge her as Malka Vashti. She's a queen. Yeah, and once again, we hear about the Yad HaSarisim. Asher lo osa says, Mamra HaMelech HaKadosh, be Yad HaSarisim. She didn't listen to what the king said, but it was after all delivered by the Sarisim. In other words, he's intimating to them there obviously should be some clemency here. There should be some leniency. She's a queen, and she got this bizarre request through Sarisim. And he thinks he can still save the day. And what happens? The final movement is up comes Memuchan, who locks, who was the bottom on the totem pole here. That we don't know. And Memuchan shows up, and all of a sudden, in Achashverosh's attempt to save face and save the queen, because now he realizes he overstepped what he would really want, doesn't really want to get rid of Vashti, Memuchan says publicly, and the stress, he makes sure to say in front of everyone. This wasn't merely about the king personally. You can't just devolve this into, oh, she's a queen and she was insulted. No, call us Sarah, call Amin. This is a national issue. And Memuchan takes it and spins it, and now Achashverosh has no choice. Achashverosh says, you're right. He follows Memuchan and even sends out the first royal proclamation about something which sounds utterly absurd. The king's first public communication after his this massive attempt to vault himself to total power was Leos kol ish sorer beveiso medaber kelshon amo. Really? Your first royal proclamation as an incredibly powerful emperor is, by the way, in bilingual homes, your wife has to speak her husband's language. Really? That's the pressing issue of the day. And that's an issue for the most powerful man in the world. Well, what an absurd fool he looks like. Ad Khan Perek Aleph. And now let's take a step back and appreciate that, as I said before, Perek Aleph sets us up for the rest of the Megillah. But I would suggest to you, and let's see how this plays out right now, that with the Malbim's approach, Perek Aleph stands on its own as well as an independent unit. An independent unit, I would suggest, studying the Achashverosh inside of every single one of us. Because let's consider the arc of Ahasuerus. Let's consider his trajectory. Here's a man who built himself up from the ground, builds, becomes incredibly powerful. Emperor of the Persian Empire, which itself was no mean feat. 127 years will hold the Kush. He's arguably already the most powerful man in the Eastern Hemisphere. Sort of the most powerful man in Europe and Asia. Wow. And what does he want? More. He already went from zero to 1 million. That's not enough. I need 2 million. And here's the incredible irony. Perek Aleph is all about Ahasuerus is seeking total power. He's seeking to be in charge of everyone else. In the end, he's the man with the least power. Vashti presses his buttons. Memuchan, who we never even heard of before, presses his buttons. In seeking to be in total charge, he ends up being controlled by everyone else. His wine gets to him, his anger gets to him, his ego gets to him, and instead of being on top of everyone, he's played by everyone. He thinks he's totally in charge, but he's actually not. And the gaiva that drives him to seek even more and more and more and more is the gaiva that ultimately undoes him. If he would have just stopped, he would have been fine. You realize, if he would have, he was already went from 1 million to pretty close to 2 million. He had this whole, everything was going well, but he needed to just keep pushing the envelope. If he would have just stopped on day 7 and not gone all the way and tried to bring Vashti in, it would have worked. But he needed to keep pushing and keep annoying and more gaiva and more ego. And that was his undoing. And in the end, Vashti is more powerful than he is. Memuchan is more powerful than he is. He thinks he's in charge, but really he's not. And this probably has significance for us in more than one way. Number one, the Gemara has asked a question, Hama min ha-Torah minayin. When we learned this, at the end of the Sirtut Sugi, we spoke about the Gemara's question, Esther min ha-Torah minayin. And where do you find Esther in the Torah? The Gemara says, Anochi haster astir panay mehem b'yamahu. The concept of Hester Panim. The Rebbe Shalom sometimes hides his face. He's still involved in our lives, but we don't see it. So presumably it's not only the fact that the word Astir, almost the same as Esther, but the concept of that pasuk is exactly the story of Esther. The Rebbe Shalom is not visible to us, not manifest, but still taking care of us. Hester Panim. The Gemara also asks, Haman min HaTorah minayin. Where do you find Haman and Chamish? But Pazit doesn't quote. Haminites. Right? Rebbe Shalom says to Adam, did you eat from the tree that I told you not to? Now what does that have to do with Haman? Well, it's the same three letters. Hey, Mem, Nun, Hamin, Haman. But presumably the Gemara's point is that those same three letters are there to indicate a thematic connection. There's some connection of ideas. And there are many ways to go with that. Different performance or different suggestions. It's something worth thinking about, of course, from now until Purim. What taka is the pshat? What's the Purim theme in Amina 8? I think the most popular approach is that part of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's question to Adam, because of course it's not really a shaila. He's not asking did you or didn't you. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is giving, it's a rhetorical question. It's a kasha. You did that? Really? It was a Pesach, the tshuva. And what's a big part of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's kasha to Adam? There were thousands, maybe millions of trees in Gan Eden. It was Gan Eden! It was paradise! It was full of beautiful trees. You had to get hung up on the one tree that you couldn't eat. That's exactly what the pasuk says. Did you eat from the tree of Shetzivisi? The one tree that I told you not to eat, Achalta, that's what you ate from? Really? Of all the options, you had to pick the only one that was treif. Come on. But we're all like that sometimes. As the Gemara in the end of the Dharm quotes from the Psukim Mishlei, Mayim Genuvim Yom Taku. There's a certain sweetness to that which is forbidden. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu built us that way. There's an allure to the forbidden, and that's what creates healthy Nisayon that we need to be aware of and over which we need to be misgaber. But Haman fell in. Fast forward a couple of years and fast forward a couple of prakim, Haman is practically speaking the most powerful man in the empire. Ahasuerus is basically letting him run the show. He's the executive vice president in the fullest sense of the term. He's running much of the known world. Everyone kowtows to him, figuratively and literally. Millions of people, at least, are bowing to him. Really, the one guy who doesn't bow to you, you're more focused on the one thing which isn't working out. Really? So there's one Mordechai that doesn't bow to you. Imagine if Haman had had better midos. He would have lasted. He had it made. But his Achilles heel is he was getting more pain from the one person who was annoying him than from the millions of people that he got pleasure from the millions of people that were subservient to him. It makes no rational sense. But that's the reality of how people often operate. If one doesn't train one's midos, we spoke about this a couple of weeks ago in Parshas Mishpatim. That's what Daz Kain Bali Tosu says about the Lakev Tashlichon Oso. We tend to, you relied on the sheepdog 1,000 times he came through for you. The one time he fails you, our natural human reaction is to be more upset about the one failure than we are grateful for the 1,000 successes. The Torah teaches us to rise above that natural but absurd midah. That's what Haman was. And ultimately, that's the chet of Adam. The whole garden is yours, but you had to get hung up on the one thing you couldn't have. How you talking? But that's human nature. Either we train ourselves to rise above it, or we are governed by it. So that's one major practical aspect of the story of Ahasuerus. Is Ahasuerus is doing, it's not just Haman. Ahasuerus is doing it too. You have so much power, but you have to go for more. And then, even in the going for more, you're already at day 187 of the parties. You already moved to Susa. You moved your Kisei HaMalchus. You threw all the parties. You upended all of the protocols. And so far it's working. You have so much. But he had to stick it to Vashti also. If he would have enjoyed the 99.999% that he had, instead of the minuscule amount he didn't yet have, it would have continued blissfully. But because he was more hung up on the little bit that he was missing than all the so much that he had, that ended up being his undoing. It's true with Haman, it's true with Ahasuerus. It's a midah of Esav. Yishli Rav as opposed to Yishli Kol. Yeah, I have plenty, but I'm still missing that. And of course it's totally fine to notice what you have and what you don't have. But if you're deriving more pain for what you don't have than pleasure for what you do have, that's a sorry way to live. Why would you want to make yourself unhappy? Why would you want to make yourself, in the language of Pirkei Avos, poor? Ezehu Asher HaSameach B'chelko. The pleasure of having what you have doesn't come from how much you have nearly as much as it comes from the extent to which you allow yourself to enjoy what you have and focus more on what you have than what you don't have. The mistake of Haman, the mistake of Ahasuerus, the mistake of Esav, the mistake of Adam. Hanin ha'eitz. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu says to Adam, you fell in. You fell in. And the second level of the message of Ahasuerus is to understand that we can often be controlled as opposed to controlling. And when we think we're in charge, we're often not. certainly in terms of Midos. Ahasuerus thinks he's in total control. It's all a facade. Everyone else is pushing his buttons. Everyone else is playing him. Vashti is playing him, Memuchana is playing him, but he thinks he's in charge. It's an illusion. He's the least in charge. And he ends up, comes out of the parak looking like a total idiot. Your first royal proclamation is about bilingual homes? That's the great issue of the day? What an absurd thing to say. But in his mind, he's writing that he's the most powerful man. It's certainly true that our Midos, as we just spoke about moments ago, I could have Midos that control me instead of my controlling them. And how sad it is, as an example, when I'm controlled by my desire for more instead of allowing myself to be happy with what I have. It's so sad to think you're in control and really you're not. And really ego is taking over. Or to be addicted to something. To think I'm so free because I do whatever I want to when in fact I'm an eved to my taiva. My taiva doesn't work for me. I work for it because if I'm not able to say no to it, now I'm working for it. It may give me the illusion of power, but the reality of bondage. And finally, in the largest level, is to recognize that we are indeed, we're sometimes enslaved by our midos ro'os, and we could choose to be otherwise. We could have the cheiros al haluchos, we could become b'nei chorin through Torah, as the Brisa in the sixth parak of Avos tells us. Real freedom is to be found through the discipline of Torah, because that allows us to really run our lives instead of our lives running us, our bad midos running us, other people running us. It's also true that if we forget about Ribono Shel Olam, we will have the illusion of Kochi Ve'Otzem Yadi, when in fact we're junior partners of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And so, that, I believe, is the first parak of Megillas Esther. The independent story of Ahasuerush. A case study in a person who thinks he's in charge. A case study in bad midos run amok, in ego run amok, in temper run amok, in taiva for power run amok, and in always focusing more on what you don't have than what you do have. Totally, he thinks it's building him up, but it's destroying him. And it leaves him looking foolish. The emperor has no clothes. He looks foolish to everyone except himself. A tremendous yesodos. Just for, again, how do we start? We start by reading the psukim. So actually noticing what's going on. The Malbim opened our eyes then to, here's what the plot really is. Here are the machinations. Here are the motivations. And going back to what Zakkai said. Is he brilliant or is he a tipish? Well, in fact, he's both. He does have brilliant plans, sort of brilliant plans. They are insightful in a shallow sort of way. He has insight into people around him, but he has no insight into himself. So he figures out how he's going to rebrand, and he figures out how he's going to communicate his message to everyone else, but he has no self-management, and that is his undoing. And this is l'chora, the independent to'eles, nevusha hetz hutzer chel doros, of Perek Rishon of Megillas Esther.